Access number 29529, Mr. Tom Austin, Reel 9. Now, after a period on these sort of gardening raids in April, the mining, you seem to switch to the Ruhr. Can you tell us about that? And I know there's one raid on Dortmund on May 23rd, you want to tell us something. What about the switch to
the Ruhr? Well, of course, we didn't know at the time. I mean, we were only given information. The planning, we didn't know about actually why it was suddenly switched. Well, it wasn't suddenly switched. I mean, they've been visiting the Ruhr throughout, but they were concentrating then on the industry in the Ruhr.
Did the Ruhr have a reputation at that time?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Ruhr was the most heavily defended area because it's like, say, the Midlands, except a bigger Midlands in this country, except much larger scale. One town after the other, heavy industry. You've got Krupps, etc. And so it was a most welcome place to go. We used to call it Happy Valley. The fact being that you got a very good reception. And of course, if you went astray at all, once you bombed your target on that particular town, you try to get out of it as soon as possible, away from the Ruhr, because otherwise you'd get the concentration right the way across. Of anti-aircraft fires and fighters, and also across the searchlight.
Right. So, anything about the first couple of raids?
Nothing particular.
They're on sort of first one on Dortmund, yeah. then Duisburg and Bochum. But
we saw fighters, but I always thought that. Providing a fighter realised you'd seen him, he wouldn't concentrate on you with the number of aircraft that were operating that night. It was much better for him to clear off and try somebody else who didn't see him. But the anti-aircraft fire, etc., and the searchlight zones, because they were operated, the searchlights, there was the radar-operated master beam, which is a bluish beam, and once that picked you up, it just went spot on. Then the rest, others would concentrate on it, and then they'd throw everything they could at you. Of course, operating then in Wellington's, so we were roughly bombing usually around about 15,000 feet. But of course, the four-engine stuff, Lancaster's, Halifax's were way up at about possibly 22. So one of the dangers, particularly over the target, was that you not only looked around you, but you looked up as well, because there could be a chap on his bombing run. It did occur quite often, obviously, that bombs were dropped through. And, of course, the other thing was, with the type of aircraft we were on, the speed, etc., we were mostly briefed to go in about the middle of the raid.
Now, what do you remember about this raid on May 23rd?
May the 23rd, particularly, we were going to Dortmund. And when we actually approached the target, it was well marked. The conditions, weather conditions, weren't bad, actually. But we made our approach and did the run in. And we were bombing on the certain markers, which the PFF had put down. And we got a hit underneath. The aircraft after that seemed flyable. We didn't have any effect. After dropping the bombs and getting the photograph, the briefing was to do a return pretty well 180 degrees back away from the target by turning right. So in other words, the target would be on your right-hand side. Well, as I say, once over the target, we did our turn, got on the return trip on 180 degrees, and we saw an aircraft on our starboard, roughly about 1 o'clock, way up at about 22,000 feet, I would have said, in a whole concentration of searchlights, and they were absolutely throwing everything up at him. Of course, there is no defined way of getting out of searchlights. You did everything possible, turn the aircraft inside out almost. And apparently, when you see somebody like this, the attitude is, well, poor so-and-so, you know, but better you than me sort of thing. But at any rate, we kept our eye on this chap, and suddenly he must have either got hit. He came screaming down, and he came actually straight across the top of us. We were about 15,000. And the searchlights followed him down, but as they came down, they came across our aircraft and locked on. In other words, they possibly they may even thought it was him, but anyway, what he was getting, we suddenly were receiving the other end of it. And naturally, we were trying to do some action for to get out of it. In actual fact, we had a sudden hit underneath, and the nose went up, and I had the bomb aimer standing by me to assist on anything like that, and I called on him to push as far as he could, but it didn't work, and so we actually pulled, and we did over the top. We actually did a loop over, and we came screaming down, and at the same time, the starboard engine caught fire, and we must have come down to, well, very low indeed, because they had flak towers in these towns in the Ruhr, quite high, where they'd concentrate flak guns. And I know that the rear gunner particularly was, well, of course, we only had the rear gunner, well, we didn't use the front guns at all, actually fired almost level. So we were way down there. And we were lucky to get it pulled out. We managed to get level. And when I looked at everything, because all the gyro instruments had toppled, and also, I got no airspeed. Now, the airspeed pitot head was on the starboard wing, so whether that actually got hit itself or whether it was part of the damage on the wing. I determined at the same time, of course, as this happened, when we got this hit, the wireless operator got injured. It was part of a nose cone or of a shell which came through underneath his compartment and caught him in the groin. Well, and so there was the necessity for somebody to attend to him and try and get him back on the bed, and at the same time to sort ourselves out and try and make getaway. Well, we actually got up to about 1,000 feet, round about there, and I decided that we'd stay at 1,000, where if we got attacked again or if the aircraft engine, the port engine went or anything, we'd have a reasonable chance of getting out. And we made for the west. We actually, the compass, the ordinary P4 compass, settled down, and we progressed towards the west, and we came out over the Scheldt estuary. And as I say, we were in quite a state then, because we the instruments had very few left, and the most worrying thing of the lot was the fact that we had no airspeed. I didn't know whether the ailerons had been damaged or anything like that. There was obviously a big hole in the front of the aircraft underneath where the wireless operator, who was sitting at the back of me, actually. And as I say, we staggered out over the Scheldt, and we got across the coast, and as we came up to the English coast, I gave a mayday call. But in actual fact, we got no answer. Now, I think it was possibly because the radio was out. But obviously, I think the transmission was okay, but not receiving. And eventually, I saw an airfield with a DREM system lighting. We didn't know exactly where we were. And the DREM system lights got put on and off. And it was fairly obvious to me that this was in response to our call. And so I made for the airfield. We did a circuit. At least we went around and went on downwind. And on downwind, I thought I would try to see if I could get the starboard engine going, which I tried, but it actually caught fire again. Now, the thing was that if you, your flaps or your ailerons were damaged or something, particularly when you're not knowing what speed you're flying at, the big fear was to stall. And so I selected the undercarriage, but only one appeared as okay. I think it was the port leg came down. And as I say, I didn't put flap down in case they'd been injured, would you literally roll over. We made our approach, and I could see the end of the runway. We actually came in, and I found out from talking to the people in the control tower afterwards that we must have come in at about 140 miles an hour when the normal speed we would be about 190. Anyway, we touched down, and I couldn't keep it straight. We veered at an angle across the runway, and we must have hit a ditch at the end of the run, and of course I didn't know exactly where we were at the time. It was very sandy, and the whole airplane collapsed, and we went into sand, and we finished up in a farmer's backyard, actually, and strangely enough, the sand put the fire out on the engine. Well, obviously, the rescue people came along, the fire engine, the ambulances, etc. We got out and we got the wireless operator out, who was badly injured. And we found out it was Mildenhall. Well, that was quite a way south of where we were intending to go, because we were stationed near Scampton in Lincolnshire, this being Suffolk. Well, the wireless operator got taken to hospital, and as I say, we got out. And of course, Mildenhall at that time were operating Stirlings. We considered ourselves very, very fortunate. I never actually saw the state of the aircraft, because this was obviously in the dark, in the middle of the night, but we didn't get an opportunity to go and investigate the following day, but it was obviously a write-off, the aircraft. So that was getting towards the end of our periods on Wellington, as a matter of fact.
Now, any other raids you particularly remember? That was on May 23rd, as
yeah.
you said.
There was another raid, but this, the one in particular I was going to mention was when we were on Stirlings. But of course, we got taken off Wellington's and we were sent.
Do you remember the raid on Dusseldorf where you had a lot of trouble with icing? It's just
yes. Well,
June
that was
11th.
we were forecast bad weather, a big front, which we couldn't get above, and we had severe icing then.
How did that affect that? I mean,
well, you get the airplane gets very heavy. It builds up, and the only answer, of course, is to get lower to get a warmer air condition to get the ice away.
And you abandoned that raid from
yeah,
the looks of it.
Yeah.
Now you then go for your training on Stirling in what June 1943.
That's right.
Now that's to number 1665 conversion unit.
Yeah, the Woolfox Lodge.
Now, does that mean you'd left the squadron? Or
oh no, the squadron as a squadron converted onto Stirlings. So we were sent to Woolfox Lodge, and of course, strangely enough, at Mildenhall, as I say, they were operating Stirlings, and that was the first time we'd been right up against them. I mean, they were much bigger. Well, they were higher off the ground, as you know, than a Lank. I mean, the pilot's seat was about 22 feet up.
Now, what did you think of it? Take us through the Stirling.
Yeah.
What did you think of it as an aircraft?
As an aircraft, it was very well built, very manoeuvrable aeroplane. But, of course, we've discovered that as far as operations went, it was not terribly satisfactory, in as much as the acceptance test for a new Stirling was to take it fully loaded up to 15,000 feet, which is the most you would normally get, in 1 hour. But as I say, at the conversion unit, because they were old aeroplanes, and without any exaggeration, I would imagine we would have had an accident almost daily. Why the undercarriage might collapse if a chap did a landing in a crosswind, etc. They were very liable, prone to this, to collapse the undercarriage. Because, as you know, the undercarriage was put on because when they developed the Stirling, it was too late in the development. They wanted a higher angle of incidence. So the way they got over it was to put this enormous undercarriage on, which lifted the whole front of the aircraft up. But as an ordinary aeroplane for flying, it was very manoeuvrable indeed. You could do a marvellous evasive action in a Stirling, definitely.
And was it better than a Wellington? Or about the same?
About the same. Now, I would say, if anything, the Wellington was better, because you could get, I mean, you could get probably up to 19,000 feet in a Wellington. But it depended what time, you were instructed to fly at, really. But certainly a Stirling wouldn't rise above that.
Did it have any advantages?
The Stirling itself? No, because, first of all, bear in mind that the bomb bays of a Stirling could only take, the largest bomb would be about a 2,000-pound bomb. You couldn't, incidentally, put a 4,000-pound bomb on it, whereas, of course, you could convert Wellington to take a 4,000-pound bomb on its own. So you could carry a big bomb load, but you certainly couldn't carry what a Lank carried. And, of course, the Lanks went up and up in use of how much they could carry. But no, I found the Stirling, as I say, was it would take a lot of punishment. And, of course, once again, we had radial engines. One of the things about the Stirling was, that we found out afterwards, the fact that it was so easily picked up by night fighters from the rear, because the glow of the exhaust of a Stirling were like four gas rings. You could see well away. And there was no means of disguising that. But as I say, the limit to your height was the big disadvantage.
Now, you were there, well, you weren't there long, were you? Just June.
Oh, no, it was only a matter of a couple of weeks, I think, if that.
Yeah,
something
back in
like
about
that.
Last week or so of June.
That's right.
and then you seem to go back on operations.
Yeah, that's right. Well, because we had to rejoin, or at least reform the squadron again, at Lakenheath, which is next to Mildenhall.
So you actually moved?
Yeah. And, of course, at Mildenhall was the airfield which we crashed in the Wellington.
So that was, well, looks like the back end of July. Or
that would be.
The beginning of July, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so what happens there? I mean, what
well, I had a...
This seems to be
a most unusual thing in a Stirling when we started operating on a Stirling from Lakenheath. Was the fact that we were briefed to go to a place called Modane, which was down towards the Alps. And it was quite a decent night, actually. And without any warning, there was a flick on the port wing, and then the starboard wing would go down, and you'd lose possibly a couple of thousand feet. When this first happened, we were up at over 10,000 feet. And there was no reason for this. I mean, the engines were operating quite all right. And this occurred, in actual fact, three times. Well, as we were going to go over the mountains, I had to abandon the trip because no way could we ever think about getting across. And I reported the matter why we returned and aborted the trip, because of the instability of the aircraft. And I don't think I was believed, actually. But the aircraft was taken by another crew later on in the week, and the pilot knew all about this occurrence that I have reported, and it happened to him. Well, directly it happened, he abandoned the trip and brought it back, and they realised there was something radically wrong with the airplane. They brought the test pilot down from Shorts to try this, and he asked for the airplane to be actually fully loaded, as you would with fuel, etc. And he took it up, threw it all round the air, apparently, and nothing seemed to go wrong until, strangely enough, when he decided to descend, and on the approach to the airfield, it did occur to him. Well, because he was prepared for this. And he managed to get it down, and his report was that, to scrap the aeroplane, the reason given was that at some time in the aircraft's life, there was very badly strained. It could have been the fact of a bad landing, etc. And at certain speeds and weights, the whole aircraft, the fuselage of the aircraft, twisted. And you lost lift altogether. And it was a most strange occurrence because when it first occurred, I hadn't got a clue what was happening. But that was the
The raid on Madain on I think it's 16th of September. Now, just before we go on, there were a couple of raids. Look, you seem to have done some raids on Nuremberg, Munich, Berlin. I don't know whether you remember that.
Yeah, the Berlin I remember particularly.
Now, that's August the 31st, so that's going back a bit. That's all right. Tell us about that raid.
Well, we were briefed in the middle, what's the name of the raid, to get in halfway through. And when we, it was actually about 9/10 cloud cover over Berlin, which was a carpet, almost like a white carpet below you. And the experience there was the fact that way above, up to 30,000 feet, the Germans were putting out fighter flares, and you could literally see the fighters manoeuvring above the target, above about 30,000 feet. And they could see you like daylight because you were silhouetted against the cloud, and they just picked off anybody they could. Fortunately, as I say, we went over the target, we bombed. We had to bomb on air bomb and air marking on by the clouds. It wasn't, we couldn't see the ground. The PFF did the marking, of course. And as far as we were concerned, it was a successful raid. But I never saw any of the ground at Berlin at all.
And that's the 31st of August.
Yeah.
There's also Mannheim. I don't know.
Well, no, again.
That's the one before Madain.
Yeah.
Now, any other? Then Hanover, a couple more on Mannheim, a couple on Hanover, a couple on one on Mannheim. Do you remember those? That's September 22nd.
Yeah. Well, there's one. One particular one I can remember pretty well was in October at Kassel.
That's October the 3rd.
That's correct.
Now, tell me about that. What do you remember about that?
Well, Kassel. It's quite a long trip, and we arrived at the target. There was a lot of anti-aircraft fire searchlights, the normal stuff. And in actual fact, we hit a thunderstorm over the target. Now, of course, at night time with QNIMS and thunderstorms, etc., you couldn't easily avoid them. And we did our run across the target, and must have gone into the bottom of a QNIM when it caused the aircraft to stall in the most peculiar sensation, in as much as everything went quiet. The aircraft, the engines stopped, and then they restarted as we came out. As I say, it was a most odd experience to contend with a thunderstorm at the same time as you were doing your bombing run. But again, it was a successful raid as far as we were concerned.
Now, that looks like it was the last one before you go to number 17 operational training unit at Silverstone.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's right. Now, yeah. Is that when you leave the squadron?
They leave the squadron.
Now, how
you
did
see?
You feel at the end of your tour? I mean, how do you feel? Do you get nervy? How do
you get a bit very cautious, I would say, towards the end. It's because I think the time that's your most vulnerable is the first few raids you do and the last few you do. You had to watch for not being overconfident for a start. But no, I think we were quite relieved on the fact of the reason, because what happened at that time when we were taken off operations was the fact that my rear gunner, who was Australian, who used to like his tipple, went to the local pub by Lakenheath, and he actually came home in the blackout, and he got knocked down by an armour lorry and killed, which is most unfortunate. As I say, and I think that was one of the reasons why they said, right, you're finished.
Because you finished after 26.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So you must have been very relieved.
Oh, yes, no doubt at all. Now, on leaving the squadron, incidentally, at that time, I was appointed as a warrant officer.
Now, what difference did that? That was while you were still at the squadron, was it?
Yeah, the reason being that operating flying four engines gave you entitlement to be upped to warrant officer. And so I put the warrant officer badges up. And when we got to Silverstone...
Now, this is where you go to number 17 operational training.
That's right.
Do you go as a crew or do you...
No, just individuals.
And what was the name of the rear gunner that was killed? Was that the one you...
Yes, that was Huey Murray. Hugh, H-U-H. G.H. Murray. And he, incidentally, is buried in the civil cemetery in Cambridge, the other side of Cambridge from the American war cemetery. But this is in a military plot within the civil cemetery there.
So you didn't go as a crew to 17?
Oh, no, no.
And now, this is at Silverstone in
North
Hants.
This is Silverstone in North Hants.
Now, what were you doing there? What was your posting
there?
Well,
the posting there was to be an instructor on Wellingtons. Now, the first thing that happened was that the wing commander flying asked me how long I'd been a warrant officer. Well, it should have been backdated, as far as I knew, and I told him that it had fairly recently been promulgated, as far as I was concerned. He said, you're not on four engines any longer, you're not entitled to it. Take it down. So I was put back to a flight sergeant. But getting back to leaving the squadron, when I left the squadron, the flight commander said to me that you'll probably hear about an interview for a commission when you get to OTU. And quite frankly, as far as I was concerned, I was quite happy to be a warrant officer. From an expense point of view, for one thing, I don't think your mess bills would have been as much as commissioned. And anyway, having been told when I got to OTU that I had to go back to flight sergeant, then incidentally, the promulgation of the DFC from the 2nd of January 1944, I was walking around with a DFC as a flight sergeant, which got its problems when I went out, because I used to get stopped by the military police and asked what the score was. And I had to have a particular chit to prove that I was entitled to the DFC, you see. Well, as I say, at that time, I was quite happy.
Now, that happened in January 44.
Yeah.
Now,
and
what happened at Silverstone?
Well, at Silverstone, I had to go to an instructor's school to get the basics of instructing on a Wellington.
Now, that was at, you've gone there in November. After a very short period, you go to this instructor's course.
That's right. You get the basics.
Now, what do you remember of that course?
Not a great deal. I mean, I'd already been flying Wellingtons, both on OTU before we got on the squadron, and also on the squadron. So it wasn't a terribly difficult thing.
And that was at number 92 instructor, number 92 group instructor's
flight.
That's
right, yes.
Up at Hayford.
Yeah.
Did you find it difficult to learn, or was it?
No. I was quite happy with the flying of Wellington again. But then we were put in charge of. I was in one of the flights as an instructor, and suddenly I got told that would I report to the group headquarters regarding the commissioning.